Happy Thanksgiving. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas. Support for KUAF comes from Pack Rat Outdoor Center, hosting their annual customer appreciation party Saturday, December 1st, from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. at 209 West Sunbridge Drive in Fayetteville. Prizes are Sega's coffee and Stone Mill snacks will be offered. More information can be found at packratoc.com.
KUAF is also supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture.
Later on this edition of Ozarks, a conversation with the author of the novel Why City, and a discussion about listening from the man who helped start StoryCorps. Dave Isay talks to Kyle about the 5th Annual National Day of Listening, when family members are encouraged to conduct oral history interviews of relatives.
First, this holiday is steeped in the legend of newcomers to a land, celebrating with people who are already here. But long before the pilgrims and the native populations gathered for that first Thanksgiving, people were already in what would eventually be called North America. One of the leading minds in figuring out when the first people made it to this continent is Michael Collins, a research professor of anthropology at Texas State University. Earlier this month, he was the latest guest to be part of the Robert L. Stigler Jr. Lectureship in Archaeology on the University of Arkansas campus. During his visit, he came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio and told me his career path began early.
I was probably about 5 years old. And I was left with my grandmother. My cousins had gone off to school. They were older. And so to entertain me, my grandmother got out my cousin's brand new golden children's encyclopedia. And she would let me sit on the floor and look at the pictures. And to this day, I remember two pictures from that. One of them was a depiction of these were little colored drawings of Neolithic people digging for flint, the English flint mines. And the other one was the Mesa Verde Pueblos. Now, this is before I could read. And here about, well, it's probably been 8 or 10 years ago now, I found a battered copy of that in a used bookstore. I bought it. And I went out and I sat down in the car and I opened that thing and I leafed through, and there were those two pictures as I remembered them.
Any idea why it made such an impression on you?
At that age.
Yeah.
And that I remembered it.
Yeah.
No, I have no idea. And then I grew up in West Texas on the High Plains during the drought of the 1950s. And wind erosion just laid that country bare.
And we should point out, drought is not used sparingly in this. This was a significant meteorological event. It was a serious drought.
That was, of the documented droughts in North America, it's either number one or number two, yeah, depending on what criteria you use. And it laid bare many prehistoric archaeological sites and paleontological sites. So I'd ride my bicycle to junior high school, and if a sandstorm came up during class, during school, my mother knew that I would not be coming home, because I would ride my bicycle out into the wind-sipped fallow fields north of town to look for artifacts or fossil bones. And I was fortunate in that I got good adult guidance. People said, well, you need to not just have these things, you need to document them, and they mean something about the past and so forth and so on. So about that time, that same drought uncovered human skeletal material on the Scarborough Ranch, just southwest of town, and that ended up being the Midland Discovery, which is one of the older bits of human remains in North America. And there was an archaeological expedition came there in 1953 to investigate that site, and I was invited out to 13 years old, invited out And I, at that time, began to meet all of the prominent archaeologists of Texas. Ended up on a first-name basis with these people. Several of them were at the University of Texas at Austin. So when I went there, I was walking into a known community. And very early on, my interest focused on those oldest of the artifact styles that I was finding, and the bones of extinct camel, horse, bison, mammoth, mastodon, which I found all of those, you know, bits and pieces, not
right.
skeletons. So the die was cast. And I joined the Texas Archaeological Society. How's this for optimism? As a life member in 1954.
You were 14.
Yeah. And I'm still a member, obviously, because I'm still alive.
Yes. No. Well, it's amazing that you have this memory of that book with those pictures, then this sort of combination of events, where you live, the time you live there, the discovery of the Midland Project, and then, not really that far away later, is Galt.
Mm-hmm.
It all kind of comes together.
If you were to write a novel of some aspiring kid's career, Galt is the site that you would use as the pinnacle of that career. I mean, it really is everything that I've been interested in all my life.
Galt is in central Texas.
It's in central Texas. It's 40 miles north of Austin. It's in Bell County.
If people are unfamiliar with Galt, it is one of, if not the most important sites for this sort of study.
It's one of the important sites for this study. In some ways, the site is extraordinary, but every archaeological site is unique. So I never like to hear somebody say this is the biggest or the best or whatever. But as a Clovis site, Clovis being that interval of 13,000 to 13,500 years ago, it was supposedly the founding peoples of the American Native Americans, always thought to have been a nomadic big game hunting culture. And Galt is the poster child to debunking that misconception. It's an enormous, what we call a base camp, where there were men, women, and children there. They were engaged in all sorts of domestic activities. I personally don't think there was any big game hunting done there. We do have some mammoth remains, but they could be just coincidence that a mammoth died there. We just don't know. So it's a site that has told us all kinds of things that we're using to sort of correct the story on Clovis.
You mentioned that for decades, really, it was thought that the first inhabitants of the Americas, 13,000 to 13,500 years ago, but recent discoveries in science and research and lab work tells us it was before that.
Well, that there certainly were people here before Clovis. There's no question about that. And now Galt has produced evidence in that realm as well. And we're currently excavating in one small area of the site, and we are aiming to expose 12 square meters of the bedrock, the limestone, 100 million year old limestone bedrock at that locality. So we know we've reached the bottom of the cultural evidence there. And we are just now coming down on that in our one excavation block. We've got some more squares that need to be brought on down that far. We dig in 1 meter squares. So we have 80 centimeters, about 2 feet, of cultural material that's older than Clovis. And it consists of a wide variety of chipstone tools, some of which are not that different from Clovis. Some of which are entirely different than Clovis. So I don't know whether we're looking at multiple occupations that we can't sort out, or we're looking at some sort of a hybrid antecedent to Clovis, a developmental sequence toward Clovis. And we may never know the real answers to those questions.
Now that we know there were people in North America before Clovis, do we know where they came from? Do we know much about them?
We don't. And if you ask three archaeologists, you'll get five opinions. we're internally, professionally conflicted over what the evidence that we do have is telling us, which most of that's good professional disagreement, and that's fine. We still have to fight a sort of a rear guard against the people who are absolutely convinced that there was no one here before Clovis. They will accept none of the evidence, as incontrovertible as it might be, that there were people here before Clovis. And that gets old. Mm-hmm. When I gave my first professional paper in which I suggested that there were people here before Clovis in 1975.
And that was not the prevailing thought at that time.
At that time, I would say fewer than 2% of North American archaeologists would even consider that possibility. And a huge, larger-than-life figure in American archaeology had convened this conference in which I gave that paper. This was James Bennett Griffin at the University of Michigan. And I gave my paper. And he dismissed it with a brush of his hand, and he said, "Those aren't my Paleo-Indians." And that was my first taste of the adversity that I was about to face. And I've stayed on that track since that time and been intrigued by, curious about, and watching for evidence for people here before Clovis. And it has been a very contentious field of endeavor. But in 1997, there were two publications that came out. The second volume of the report on Monte Verde in Chile, which is a site that had huge, compelling evidence for people in southern Chile 1,500 years before Clovis. And the volume was so compelling that there really was a sea change. More people after the publication of that volume accepted the idea of older than Clovis than had before by a significant number. In that same year, that volume was widely distributed in Virginia. There's an archaeological site known as Cactus Hill. It was first published in 1997. Very limited dissemination of that report, but it actually met the gold standard for the case for older than Clovis. And it was a site with a Clovis archaeological component and an underlying component below it. And that means that physically you couldn't read that anyway, but the other one had to be older, even if it was just a few minutes older.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1999, there was a conference called Clovis and Beyond in Santa Fe, New Mexico, in which all of the people that were interested in that topic gathered and gave papers and had discussions and displayed collections and so forth and so on. So those three events I sort of see as the turning point, but they certainly weren't the first time that evidence for people before Clovis had been made public. The longest running controversial case is Meadowcroft Rock Shelter in Pennsylvania that in 1976, I believe it was, Jim Atavasio and his colleagues there published radiocarbon dates for archaeological components at about 14,000 and about 16,000 years old. And these were buried underneath a standard archaeological sequence that went from about historic contact times back to about 10,000 years ago. And to this day, there is still unrelenting criticism of that site. It just was a lightning rod.
Because it just shook up the status quo?
Yes, absolutely. And there are others, many of which have faded off the radar screen since then, and they weren't valid cases, but I think Meadowcroft is. I listed among the sites that I consider evidence for people here before Clovis.
Thank you so much for your time.
You bet, I enjoyed it.
Thank you. Michael Collins is a research professor of anthropology at Texas State University. Earlier this month, he was the latest guest to be part of the Robert L. Stigler Jr. Lectureship in Archaeology on the University of Arkansas campus.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas, and joining me from his home in Pencil Bluff, Arkansas, is Wade Rivers. Hello, Wade.
Good morning to you, and good to hear from you.
Yes. You are the author of several books, a few of them recently released, but most of them are set in Arkansas, yes?
Yes. I've lived in Arkansas most of my life. I've traveled around the world, but I don't think there's anything quite like Arkansas. And so they say, as a writer, you're supposed to write about what you know about. Everything I've written, except for one book, all takes place in Arkansas.
So one of the books that I read was Why City. Is that your first book?
That was my first book, and it was, I don't know how other writers do it, but I never really intended on writing a book. I was literally driving down the road, and I saw a truck coming my way and had a very beautiful woman in it. But it was an old beat-up truck, and I looked at her, and she was wearing some, I could tell it was expensive jewelry and a nice watch, and she was smoking a cigarette, and her hair was blowing out the window. We passed, and it was about a mile later, I just had this vision of this lady living on this gigantic ranch, very wealthy but very humble, and all of a sudden this story came to me, and within about the town I was going to was about another hour away. It took me about 4 hours to get there, and I had at least 60% of the story in my head, and that's how Why City started.
So did you pass through Why City on this
I
trip?
I had been through Why City so many times in my life, and a lot of people, if you were going to, Why City to me is a metaphor, okay? It's like the proverbial fork in the road, that people come to, and I allude to this.
Well, it's where Highway 71 and 270.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. And everybody in these parts, they go through here. A lot of people traveling, they will go, Why City? I've been through there, because the name just rings out. So I put the place of my story, and I think it's the cross between a thriller and just a old-fashioned drama suspense. But I put the story in Why City, where the ranch where this lady lives. Many different people since it's come out, a lot of policemen, detectives, who contacted me because they read the story and they said they know it had to happen someplace. They were positive it wasn't a fiction book. And they asked me, and I told them, I said, no, it's just purely a creation. They asked me, how was it so real? Because it reads just like, almost like a true crime novel. And the reason is that I've been in the jail where most of this takes place hundreds of times. And that's another story of why I've been in that jail, but that's why it reads just like a story that if you'd go into a small town jail in America today, it's going to be just like what this book says.
And the book actually starts out, the first chapter is in this police station, and they're bringing a fugitive.
Yes.
Back to Why City.
Yes. It starts out, I think, very quickly, and it I was throughout the story, it picks up and it starts moving and moving, and everybody has told me that it becomes very climactic towards the end, which I think makes a very good story. It's also it doesn't have what I call a predictable ending. You know, I wrote this story different than I think most stories are written today. You're not even sure exactly what the crime was until you get about halfway through it. And the reason being, I wrote it from the perspective of the sheriff. And if you're a sheriff and you're investigating something, you don't know yourself. And then when you get to the point where you think you know, you're not sure that you really do know. But I'm real, you know. So these characters come across very real. And my sheriff is no Superman. He's in the NY City. He's just, you know, he's just a good old boy. But he's not a Bubba. You know, he's not a racist. He's a cop trying to do his job, and he's in a very difficult situation. And I think the story reads well. But I'm proud of my newer works too.
You mentioned newer works. I'm up here in Fayetteville, and we're, you know, home of the University of Arkansas. And one of your newer works takes place on the University of Arkansas campus, a book called Texted?
Yes. I went to the U of A myself my first 2 years in college, and I went to the University of Oregon. And I also was in junior high up in Fayetteville. And then, so I know the university well. And this book was probably the easiest book that I've ever written. And it just takes place because I'm very familiar with all the scenes, the campus, and so forth. Here again, I think it's a different story where, you know, you've got this beautiful young lady. It's her first day on campus. She doesn't know anybody. And she starts getting texts from anonymous sources. It quickly becomes, a very gripping thriller in that, as the reader, you can see that she's heading down a dangerous trail. She can't see it, okay? And her perspective is different from other people. But
the reader can see it.
Yes, well, the reader can see it, except that, like everything else, it takes a real hook towards the end. And I don't want to give away too much, but on the story, you know, I'm proud of this fact, is that I think anybody can relate to it. You know, if you could imagine that on any given day, all of a sudden you get a text. I think everybody's gotten a text or an email, and you're going, who's this from?
Mm-hmm.
But what happens to her is that I really get into her psyche, and she is, if you've ever met somebody who's extremely talented or beautiful or what have you, but also they are self-conscious about themselves, and she's in a new environment, so quite naturally, she's drawn to whoever is texting her. And this person or this entity that begins giving her information really begins to take over her life. I mean, she'll be talking to her boyfriend, and all of a sudden her phone will ring. She'll look down there, and it will say things like, he's lying. I think it's a great novel as well. I put that one in another book. I put two novels together in the same book, and the book is called Thriller Vision. And Text is the first novel in it. The second one is The Yeoman, and both of them take place here in Arkansas.
Okay. So we first talked about Y City, and then we talked about Text. And in Y City, you write from the point of view of the sheriff. You know, and I'm kind of picturing a middle-aged guy. And then here you are writing from the point of view of an 18-year-old girl.
Right.
What is that process like? How do you write from two completely different point of views?
Well, you know, there's like a lot of people upstairs in my head. You know, the characters come to me. You know, I don't, honestly, writing to me is the easiest thing in the world because these people speak to me. And I have never, I write poetry too, and I write short stories. I've never said, I'm going to write a story about this. It doesn't really happen that way. The story comes to me, and I feel that really I'm just the narrator, okay? I'm just narrating what they are experiencing, you know, regardless of whether it's the sheriff, the the lady in text or whatever it is. And I want to become a writer or be the writer that I know a lot of good writers, but they have four or five books, and they all are the same. And I never have wanted to be that. So every book that I do put out is completely different than any other book.
You say that they're all different. So are you writing for the same audience every single time?
Well, no, not really. I think the audience I was speaking to primarily for text would be a younger generation that is, I mean, they're born with cell phones today. Okay? I mean, they see little kids and so forth, and they live in the electronic age. I'm older. We've seen a transition in my age. But Y City, I think, is I have people who have come to me and from all ages. Most appealing thing or satisfying thing is that when I go someplace, I'm at a book signing, and I've had 15-year-old kids come up and said, I read Y City. I've had retired people come up and said, you know, I want to appeal not only to people here in Arkansas, but obviously people across the nation.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Rivers.
Hey, it's been my pleasure.
I spoke with Arkansas author Wade Rivers earlier this week. His books are available for Kindle at Amazon.com. To find out when to expect them in paperback, visit waderivers.com. This is Ozarks at Large.
Happy Thanksgiving. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Spending just a bit of Thanksgiving Day with us, Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Before I waddle off to eat more food, There is something going on tonight. You can get out of the house.
Okay.
Jamie Wolfe and the Wranglers, a country rock band based in Northwest Arkansas, you've seen them at Bikes, Blues, and Barbecue and many other area venues, are performing at 8 o'clock tonight at the Cherokee Casino in West Siloam Springs, and it's free.
Really?
So get out of the house.
Okay.
Get away from the relatives. I love mine, but, you know.
Right.
Thank you, Becca. Cherokee does not close on Thanksgiving.
Apparently not.
It's funny. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Ozarks at Large. If, after the leftovers, the parades on TV, football, and more football, you feel the need for something a bit more personal, why not engage in the 5th annual National Day of Listening? The day after Thanksgiving has been set aside as a time to record interviews with loved ones by the people behind StoryCorps. Dave Isay, the founder of the StoryCorps idea, was on our program 5 years ago as the tradition of National Listening Day was about to be launched. Monday, I reached him at his office to see what's happened since that first National Day of Listening and what was planned for this year.
Well, we're continuing to push on. The idea is, as you know, on the day after Thanksgiving, to take an hour out to record a loved one as the least expensive but most meaningful gift we can give, kind of StoryCorps do-it-yourself. And we've been growing it slowly every year. I mean, I think the biggest thing that's changed, and we will keep growing it until this thing, we hope, becomes, you know, something that happens across the country every year. We've got a long way to go, but we've also got a lot of patience. The technology has changed a lot since we first spoke. So, you know, now, you know, most everybody has a mobile phone that can do an audio recording. And this year we have a partnership with a website called SoundCloud, which is the kind of the YouTube of sound, which makes it incredibly easy just to record a conversation with your cell phone and then hit a button and boom, it's up on this website that collects these StoryCorps DIY interviews. This year we also have started over the last couple of years having themes for the National Day of Listening. Last year StoryCorps had a big national project honoring teachers across the country. So the idea was to find a teacher from your past and thank them by doing an interview with them. And this year we have a big StoryCorps initiative launching in a couple of weeks honoring post 9/11 veterans, active duty, and families across the country. And this year for the National Day of Listening, we're asking folks to find someone who served in the military or a family member of someone who served in the military and do an interview with them on the National Day of Listening. Now, of course, if that's not possible, then or you'd prefer to record a family member, that's fine as well. The idea is to take an hour and to record a story.
What's so interesting about this year's theme, and this is, I have personally heard from a couple of people in just the last couple of weeks who talked to a relative about military service.
Yep.
And another relative was there and said, I haven't heard this story ever.
Yep.
And it's one of those subjects where so few of us know these experiences and to hear them from other people is amazing.
You know, it reminds me of when StoryCorps first opened. We've been around for about 9 years now. We had, within the first week, there was a couple who came to the booth, and it was a wife and a husband. They'd been married many, many years. They were an older couple. And the husband, the wife asked the husband about World War II, and he starts talking about it and starts crying. And at the end of the interview, the facilitator, who's the person who's in the booth with the couple, asked what it was like for them. And the wife said, you know, I've been married to this man for 60 years, and this is the first time I've ever seen him cry. So there is something about that, you know, the formality of doing an interview, of asking these questions, and of, you know, kind of closing the doors and being in a quiet place and sitting with someone that causes really remarkable things to be said, whether it's about military or just about life. And it's a pretty wonderful and valuable experience. I hope folks will consider doing it.
You mentioned there's something about being in a quiet room and just listening. We all have a lot of conversations every day, but when you're talking to someone and you are intently wanting to hear what they say, and this National Day of Listening kind of sets that up, it can be a far different conversation, even if you don't realize it till the first few minutes in, when it's just the two of you or three of you and you're specifically talking about someone's experiences, it becomes a completely different sort of conversation.
It does, and I mean, I think you know this. It's the microphone gives you the license to have conversations you don't normally get to have. We've recorded about 50,000 StoryCorps interviews across the country with about 100,000 people, because people come in pairs. And I would almost guarantee that and many times the people who come to StoryCorps know each other very well. You know, husband and wife, a parent and a kid, a grandparent and a grandkid. And I can almost guarantee you that there's not a single one of those 50,000 conversations where no matter how well you thought you knew that person who you're in the booth with, you didn't find out something new. It's almost guaranteed. I mean, there are two things that are almost certain in every StoryCorps interview. One is that you're going to find out something about this person who you're listening to that you didn't know before. And the second thing is that when you're done, it's something you will never regret. You're always going to be glad you did it.
Sometimes the interesting parts, too, are the periphery. You may know that there's a big event.
Yep.
But in the course of talking about that big event, here's something that perhaps the person you're interviewing has never thought was that important, but because it happened in the past or a time you're not aware of, they may think it's a small detail, but it might be the most interesting thing that comes out of that conversation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, as you're doing these conversations, if you go on our website, nationaldayoflisting.org, we have two websites. One is storycore.org and the other is nationaldayoflisting.org. And StoryCorps can get you to National Day of Listening. But it'll give you instructions, very, very simple instructions for how to do these interviews. And you're absolutely right. I mean, there are details that come out that will surprise you, you know. And the trick is, when you're doing these interviews, to listen very closely. And to, you know, do follow-up questions that interest you. So if there is something that comes up that you want to talk more about, you can say, you know, Dad, can you tell me a little bit more about that? Always when you take the time to do something like this, the magical things happen over those. We suggest 40 minutes because, as you said, when you're listening intently, it's quite it can be quite tiring. So 40 minutes is usually kind of the sweet spot for where people start to get tired, but you still have enough time to cover a lot of ground.
And at those websites, you also have sort of advice of how to, you know, do the initial approach. Because not everyone, when they're first approached with the idea of being interviewed or, you know, being asked about their life or an oral history, will be quick to respond positively or right away.
Yeah. And, you know, you don't want to, this is not, you know, forced service.
Right.
You don't want anybody to do this who doesn't want to. But, you know, we found that, you know, we've had a lot of experience doing these interviews, and there are people who say, yeah, I don't have a story. And, you know, one of the things that you may want to say to those people, and invariably it's those people who never want to stop talking once you get them going. But one thing you may want to say is, look, this isn't for you, this isn't for me, this is for your kids or your grandkids or your great-grandkids. Just try. And usually people will then be willing to talk. You may want to, if it's you and a parent and you think that a grandkid will have more luck, and has the grandparent has a softer spot for that grandkid, have the grandkid do the interview. But people want to be listened to, and people want to be heard. And this act of saying to someone, I want to interview you about your life, is one of the most profound ways to tell someone how much they mean to you. And that act of 40 minutes with no TV, no cell phones, no distractions, just looking a loved one in the eye and saying, who are you, what have you learned in life, tell me about whatever experience, whether it's military, whether it's marriage, whether it's whatever it is, work experience, it's really a wonderful gift to give to another human being.
You know, the knee-jerk sort of joke is to mention that Thanksgiving is horrible because people are together, maybe family members who don't agree politically, and
right,
and then we're coming out of an election season when,
yep.
So the knee-jerk thing is to say you don't want to be around people, you go, you eat the turkey and stuff and get out of there. This day, this National Day of Listening, seems to be a great way to slice through the cynicism and the snark that can be out there.
It is, you know, and I think that it's a very good point that you raise. And you know, one of the things about StoryCorps is that, I think that what you don't want to do with a StoryCorps interview, if you have a relative who's, you know, you don't agree with politically or whatever the fight is, that's not what you want to talk about. Someone said to me last week, I don't even remember who it was, but someone said that, you know, if you get down to it, there's probably 1% that people disagree on, even when they disagree, you know, the people who are most at odds, and 99% of everything else everybody just agrees on, you just focus on that 1%. So if you have whoever it is, a relative, and you can ask them, you know, what was the happiest moment of your life, or, you know, what are you proudest of, how do you want to be remembered? And I think that helps us remember that that these divides, you know, maybe aren't as great as we think, even though there might be stress around the Thanksgiving table. And when you get right down to it, you know, it's our family, it's our relationships, it's being kind to one another that really matters. And we hope that that StoryCorps helps remind people of those, you know, simple truths.
Thank you very much for your time, Dave.
Kyle, happy holidays.
To you too. Dave Isay is a founder of StoryCorps and an organizer of the annual National Day of Listening. It's scheduled for tomorrow. I talked with him Monday. You can find out much more about tips for interviewing and how to load the conversations to SoundCloud at the websites nationaldayoflistening.org, storycorps.org, or soundcloud.com.
To the tears that fall from my eyes. Come on, baby. Listen.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us is Jody Beznoska, who is Vice President of Communications at Walton Arts Center.
Hello, and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving. Hi. Thank you.
What's your favorite Thanksgiving food? Do you have one?
Well, unofficially, it's stovetop stuffing. Officially, it's my mom's turkey.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. All right. Christina?
My great aunt Monica makes, you know, a sweet potato with pecans and brown sugar on top. So
hard to
that's
go
got to be
that.
The favorite.
Yum.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Pumpkin pie for me.
Oh, pumpkin pie's good. I'm a recent convert to pumpkin pie.
Oh.
Didn't used to like pumpkin pie.
I could
really
do pumpkin
like
almost anything.
Yeah.
All right. Walton Arts Center is closed today.
Correct. Yes.
But tomorrow?
No, we actually, our offices and our doors will be closed tomorrow. However, okay. Our website will be open.
Okay.
And along with everyone else in the world who's doing a Black Friday event, we are as well. We will turn off all of our order fees on Black Friday, so you can save a couple bucks if you come on board and buy over the weekend.
And that is anything that is on the season?
Yep, that is Walton Arts Center programming and also Theater Squared and Sona programming as well. That
okay.
does not include the AMP. Or any of our renters or clients.
Right.
So if for some reason you're buying one of those events and you see fees, that's why.
Okay.
But it's for all WAC programming and all T2 and Sona programming, too. Great way to save some money.
And you're doing something for Cyber Monday
as well? We're getting a little twisted. we actually decided to do a Real People Monday. So instead of Cyber Monday, instead of it being the online thing, we want to talk to people. So we will have some special deals. I think they relate to Billy Elliot and Catch Me If You Can, our two Broadway shows. And we want you to call us. So instead of going to our website and not talking to us, please give us a call. And our reps will be asking you maybe a question about your favorite holiday song and having a little chit-chat about the holidays with you. And we'll play that up on Facebook and have some fun with that. And then if you do the very radical thing of actually coming to see us, like, you know, walking or driving and parking and coming in and visit us, we'll have a little prize for you as you come in. So we just figured, since we're all there in the office on Cyber Monday, why not have it be all about the real people? So, and we will have, I think the deals are $10 off for certain nights of the week on Catch Me If You Can and Billy Elliot.
And Billy Elliot is the next thing happening? Is
yeah,
that right?
In between, like the week right after Thanksgiving, we will have the All Is Calm show on the 10x10 art series.
That's right.
That's with Cantus and Theater Latte Da doing a presentation about the Christmas Truce of 1914. That's a 10x10 art series show, so those tickets are only $10. But after that, we'll have a jazz show on the 1st of December, the Sean Jones Quartet.
Quartet, right.
Yep, and then... Yes. Then we will have Billy Elliot the musical for a full week, Tuesday the 4th through Sunday the 9th. Wonderful Broadway show featuring music from Elton John, lots of wonderful dancing, and really excited to have Billy Elliot. It's not been a show that's been to Northwest Arkansas ever, so kind of psyched for that. So you can get your tickets to that without fees and over the weekend of Thanksgiving, and then on Monday, right after Thanksgiving, if you call in, you could get a deal on certain nights of the seats, and you could also have some fun talking to our box office.
Excellent.
You mentioned Catch Me If You Can. Mm-hmm. When is that?
That is right after the Christmas and New Year's holiday.
Okay.
So that starts on January, I think it's the 7th or the 8th. Of course, I could just look it up. Yes, it starts on the 8th. That is the musical based on the movie, the DreamWorks movie, which starred Tom Hanks and Leonardo DiCaprio. That would be a perfect Christmas or holiday gift, especially if you do it without any fees or if you get a deal. But, yeah, tickets to a show for that hard-to-buy person. And Catch Me If You Can, I think it will be a show that everyone will like because it is a big song and dance Broadway musical, but it's beautiful, it's fun, it's cheeky. It has a little bit of a love story, but it is more about the con story of Catch Me If You Can, with some incredible dancing and kick lines and, you know, big vaudeville-type numbers. So that will be tremendous fun. That's January 8th through the 13th. So be a great thing to get if you're looking for that hard-to-buy person, something to get for them.
You can walk up on Monday, but you can go online at any time.
Anytime, waltonartscenter.org or 443-5600. And like you said, we'd love to see you. You can come down to the box office. Parking is always free till 2 p.m.
You know, I went to Walton Arts Center on Thursday afternoon. I had to do something quickly there at the box office. And Eileen Ivers Band was playing for schools.
Yeah.
And you walked through, but you guys had it on the monitor and you could hear it. I kind of lingered for a while in the lobby, found reasons to stick around because it was kind of like a quasi-free show for me for about 10 minutes.
That's kind of a prize.
Yeah,
it is. That's one of the bonuses of working there. I mean, I did the same thing. I decided to pop my head down for 15 minutes and listen to her play for students.
Yeah.
It was really, really fun to watch them. This is one of the shows where sometimes when you do a theatrical show for kids, you want them to be quiet. You want them to pay attention and learn the rules of the theater. This one, they were clapping and dancing and singing along, and it was great. It's a perfect little segue because those are the sorts of things, if you think about Thanksgiving, those are the sorts of things we're really, really thankful for at Walton Arts Center, that we can do programming like that for kids, and we can only do it because of supportive people. We're a nonprofit, so that means people give to us, and that happens because of them.
Because those kids who were seeing Eileen Ivers, they did not pay a ticket fee.
They may have.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
okay.
Depending on the deal that happens with their school. Those shows do come with a small fee, but it's nowhere near what you or I would pay.
Okay.
In some cases, it's a dollar. Some cases, it's two.
Okay.
And different schools treat it differently. Some schools will actually pay for it for the kids because they think it's an important part of their, you know, their education. And some will pass the fee on to the parents.
Okay, one last question, because this is a question apparently some people might be asked on the phone or in person on Monday. What's your favorite holiday song?
Oh, my gosh. My
favorite. See, that's what's going to happen when people call and they get this.
Oh, I know it.
So
no.
You got to.
It's
know.
Oh, Holy Night.
Oh, Holy Night.
That is definitely my favorite song.
What's the name? Gloria, you know.
Oh.
You know the one?
Yeah, the one with the long
Yes.
I don't know the name of it.
That's from Handel's Messiah.
Yes.
But I like that
one. It's the Alleluia Chorus.
Yeah, Alleluia Chorus. Wow, you guys went classy. Mine is 2,000 Miles by the Pretenders.
Well, my version of Oh Holy Night that I like the best is the one from Home Alone. So there you go.
Okay.
I declassed that a little bit.
Okay, thank you.
Right. Well, Jody, thank you for stopping by.
Thank you, and happy Thanksgiving.
Yes.
To you too.
Jody Besnoska is Vice President for Communications with Walton Arts Center. So you want to get out of the house tomorrow, but you're not all that interested in the sales, lines, and elbows associated with the Black Friday hoopla. Devil's Den has your answer. This week, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda was there and talked to Rebecca Penny, park interpreter. She spoke about several things, including the Devil's Den answer to Black Friday.
We're calling it Green Friday, however. We really want people to appreciate what's important about the holidays, and we believe that spending time with your friends and families and getting out and appreciating good health and beautiful nature. So we're encouraging people to come to the park for hikes, crafts, and family time to just really get back to the core of what's important and what the holidays are all about.
Have you guys done that one before?
We try to celebrate Green Friday the day after Thanksgiving every year. Sometimes we don't make it such a big event because we're off spending time with our families. But this is not the first year that we've done it. It is pretty popular, especially with the forecast. The park is going to be full of visitors, but we also want to encourage people to come out from all over Northwest Arkansas to explore. It's going to be a beautiful day. Don't spend it inside, sleeping, watching football games, but get out with your family and have a good time.
Rebecca Penny is a park interpreter at Devil's Den State Park.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 22nd of November, 2012. It's the feast day of Saint Cecilia, the patron saint of musicians, because she sang to God as she died a martyr's death. It was on this day, 1963, about 12:30 in the afternoon, President John F. Kennedy was fatally shot while riding in a motorcade in Dallas, Texas. The Warren Commission concluded that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone in shooting the president, a conclusion that less than half of all Americans believe. Don DeLillo's novel Libra is about the Kennedy assassination. He wrote, "What has become unraveled since that afternoon in Dallas is the sense of a coherent reality most of us shared. We seem from that moment to have entered a world of randomness and ambiguity." Today is Thanksgiving Day. It was in the fall of 1621, the Plymouth colonists, barely surviving the previous winter, they'd lost about half their population, put on a feast along with the Wampanoag people and their chief Massasoit, who had been friendly to the Pilgrims, helped teach them how to live in the New World, a man known as Squanto, who was a Patuxet Indian living with the Wampanoag tribe, and who knew English because he'd been a slave in England. It was Squanto who taught the settlers how to plant corn and beans and squash and how to catch eel and shellfish. So, on this day, 1621, the Pilgrims held a harvest festival. They had seven houses there in Plymouth and a meeting house and storehouses, not enough room for all of their guests. They had about 90 Wampanoag joining 50 English settlers. So they built temporary shelters. The feast went on for more than just one day. They had squash and venison and cabbage and corn and onions. The Wampanoag got to taste cinnamon and ginger, nutmeg, pepper. And in between the feasting, they played games and sports, and they danced and they sang. It was in 1863, in the wake of the Battle of Gettysburg, that Abraham Lincoln issued a Thanksgiving proclamation declaring the fourth Thursday in November the National Thanksgiving Day. But it was not made official by Congress until
1941. Here's a poem for today, a poem from the first book published in America, the Bay Psalm Book of 1640. Psalm 23. The Lord to me a shepherd is, want therefore shall not I. He in the folds of tender grass doth cause me down to lie. To waters calm me gently leads, restore my soul doth he. He doth in paths of righteousness for his name's sake lead me. Yea, though in valley of death's shade I walk, none ill I'll fear, because thou art with me, thy rod and staff my comfort are. For me a table thou hast spread in presence of my foes. Thou dost anoint my head with oil, my cup it overflows. Goodness and mercy surely shall all my days follow me, and in the Lord's house I shall dwell so long as days shall be. Psalm 23 from the Bay Psalm Book of 1640. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Wall Street Journal, with features written to help discover something new every day, including weekends. Subscriptions to the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition at wsj.com/getweekend. And by the Poetry Foundation, you can turn your iPhone or Android into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's poetry app, available to everyone online at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Kathy Roach and Nick Vetter, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, and Pencil Bluff.
Where is Pencil Bluff?
It's actually in between Mena and Hot Springs. That's where the author Wade Rivers was from. So he said it's population 200, but they like to say population 2 million, counting all the cows and chickens.
Yeah. So. You know, I grew up in a town. Lakeview now is, I think, 600 or 700. But when we moved there, when my parents moved me there in 1960, I think the sign said 102. So,
and it's not very many.
No, and no real cows or chickens either. So squirrels would have pumped up the volume. All right. Do you have any Thanksgiving traditions that you follow?
Not really.
Watch football? Do you watch Macy's Day Parade?
I do like to get up and watch the Macy's Day Parade. Yeah.
Yeah. I do too, and it's weird because I get frustrated every time they stop the float to lip sync. But every year I kind of sit myself in front of the TV to watch it.
I used to always color with my cousin while we watched as a child.
So, a long lost
we don't do that anymore, but.
Right. So, and do you do the Black Friday thing?
No.
I don't either. Oh, I don't either. Not even close. And the Small Business Saturday comes up, and it's all over the place.
That sounds more appealing.
I agree. All right. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
You and I back together Sunday morning at 9 for Weekend Ozarks at Large. Thank you.
Thank you.